Last week we looked at the first half of the book of Judges. This week we'll finish up the book and look at the second half and move on from there next week. The book of Judges comes right on the heels of the book of Joshua, which comes right on the heels of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And it's just we're just continuing the story. After Moses brought the people out of Egypt into the up to the borders of the Promised Land, which is a story we have through Deuteronomy, then Joshua took over, and we have the story of Joshua bringing the Israelites into the Promised Land and the conquest that the victories that God gave them as he gave them this land that he had promised to do so. All of that is in the story in the stories in the book of Joshua. And then we have the book of Judges. What happened after Joshua was gone? And we see a cycle repeated over and over and over again. And when you really get down to it, it's the same cycle that we saw back in Genesis, chapters 4 through 11, when we looked at what happened after the first sin. It's the same cycle we've seen with the Israelites in the wilderness. It's the same cycle we see throughout the Bible. It's the same cycle we see in our own lives. And that's a cycle of sin, judgment, and grace. That we sin, God is a just God and must judge that sin, and so he punishes that sin. But God is also a loving and merciful God and comes and follows that with his grace. And we see this cycle repeated over and over again in the book of Judges. We'll see it again today. Let's kind of dive in. Let's remind ourselves, though, as we look at the transition from Moses to Joshua to the book of Judges, the people were given a set of responsibilities, and that's the same responsibility that God gave back in Genesis to his people, to Abraham and his descendants, even to his people before Abraham, to Noah and his descendants, to Adam and his descendants. And that is to be God's people, to love God, to follow him, to obey him, to be the kind of people living in a covenant relationship with God that he wants us to be. And that's all spelled out. The Israelites were called to be a special, separate, cut-off people, people through whom God could reveal himself to the world. Okay, and reveal to the world what it means to be God's people. So there were expectations placed on them. Before the Israelites crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land, we have in Numbers 33 some commands that Moses gave them when he was still around. Verse 50, it says, "On the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, Yahweh said to Moses, 'Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all of the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all of their carved images and destroy all their cast idols and demolish all of their high places. Take possession of their land and settle in it because I have given you this land to possess.'" Okay? So, as they went across the Jordan River into Canaan, the Promised Land, God said, "I've given this to you. Take it. It's yours." And in doing so, in taking it, wipe out everyone that's there. Drive them out. Okay? Driving out, we saw, it means to wipe them out. Do not leave any of them there. Okay? Why? Why was it important for Israel to drive out the inhabitants of the land and not leave any of them there? Going on. "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. And then I will do to you what I plan to do to them." So it was important for the Israelites, important for their relationship with God, important for their faithfulness, for their obedience to God, to not have these people and their practices around them. Okay, as we live around people, we pick up their practices. We accept things that they do that we might not otherwise accept. And God knew that if they did not drive these people out, that they would be a temptation to them and threaten their ability to be the covenant people, their ability to be, to fulfill the destiny that God had called them to be. So he said, if you don't drive them out, there will be barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. So you can see the painfulness of that. So did they? Well, you have this story then after Moses. Well, even when Moses is around, they conquer the eastern side of the Jordan River, the land of Gilead and further north. But then Moses dies. He's not allowed to cross the Jordan River. And he dies, and Joshua takes over. We have in the book of Joshua these stories of these conquests, of God giving this territory to them. So while Joshua was around, were they able to drive out all the inhabitants of the land as God had commanded? Joshua chapter 13 says, when Joshua was old and well advanced in year, Yahweh said to him, you're very old. So in other words, okay, Joshua, your task's done. Okay, you don't have many more years left, so you're done. And he goes on, he says, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. And he goes on and describes some of the large areas of land that were still not taken. Okay. So it was left then to the people who were still there after Joshua passed on. And we see that in the book of Judges. Did they finish their job soon after Joshua died? Chapter 1, verse 29. Well, actually, at the first part of chapter 1, we saw last week that they started to, and there was some efforts. But verse 29 is just one example of many. You can look at verses 27 through 36 to see a bunch of examples. 29 said, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. And so what we saw last week is, no, they did not drive them all out. They did not drive out the inhabitants and wipe them all clean. They wiped some of them clean and drove some of them out, but they left a lot of them in, especially the ones that were a little tougher to move. And those created problems for them. How did God respond to Israel's neglect? Now, you kind of see they kind of got a little lazy. They didn't complete the job. They didn't complete the task that God had given them. It was too easy to stay at home and take it easy and leave those people. So how did God respond? Chapter 2. The angel of Yahweh went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you've disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now, therefore I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. Okay? So God came to them and said, you haven't done this. You haven't completed the task. You're act like you're done, and you're not going to remove them. You've left these people. You've left their gods. You've left their altars. You've left their high places. You've left their shrines and their Asherah poles. And I told you to destroy all that. And because you have disobeyed me and you have not cleaned these out, then I'm not going to clean them out for you. I'm going to leave them there. And they'll be a pain in the rear for you. They will be big trouble for you. Okay, so God decided he was going to leave those peoples, leave their altars, leave that to be a snare to them. So that's the basis for what we see in the stories then in the book of Judges. And the problems that happen in the book of Judges are a result of that. Now, did they intend to be faithful? Did they intend, you know, was it just that, oh, yeah, okay, we got most of them, that's good enough, right, God? Did they have intentions to drive out the inhabitants and clean them out and to be faithful to God? What was their, were they faithful or people or unfaithful? Well, if we look back at 24, before Joshua died, some of his last words to the Israelites, great words, some good memory verses here. Starting in verse 14 says, now fear Yahweh and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt and serve Yahweh. But if serving Yahweh seems undesirable for you, then choose for yourselves this day who you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. But as for me and my household, we will serve Yahweh. Okay, so he challenged them to decide. You decide now. I'm not going to be around here to make sure that you stay faithful to God. So you decide now while I'm here. Are you going to be faithful to the gods of our forefathers, back Abraham's forefathers that worshipped on the other side of the Euphrates River? Okay? God called them away from that. Yahweh called them away from that. Are you going to be faithful to the gods of the Egyptians, the gods that that Yahweh conquered when he brought you out of Egypt? Are you going to be faithful to the gods of the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Hittites, the various etceterites that God conquered to give you this land? Or are you going to be faithful to God? Are you going to be faithful to Yahweh? Me and my household will be faithful to Yahweh. And so how did they respond to that challenge? Verse 24, and the people said to Joshua, "We will serve Yahweh our God and obey Him." So they committed themselves. And you see that they were very sincere about that and committed themselves to faithfulness to Yahweh and completing the tasks, that the jobs that Yahweh had given them. So did they remain faithful? That was at least their intention. Did they? Chapter 2, verse 7. The people served Yahweh throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things that Yahweh had done for Israel. So as long as Joshua was there, and as well as the elders that had served with Joshua, as well as the people who saw the great and mighty deeds that God did through Joshua and through the great victories coming into the Promised Land, while those people were still around, the people were faithful. But then verse 10, after that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who neither knew Yahweh nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh and served the Baals. They forsook Yahweh, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked Yahweh to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherah. They forgot God. They forgot Yahweh after a generation. They served the Baals, the gods of the Canaanites there. They served the Asherahs, which are the goddesses of the Canaanites. So they lost faithfulness. Why? Why did they fall so easily? The very next generation, it says, that they forgot God. Why so fast? Why? How could they forget, especially after all the great and mighty things that God had done for them and the great stories that they had of that? Chapter 3, verse 5, the Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, and all the etceterites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Why? Because they had not driven the inhabitants from the land. They left the peoples there. They commingled with the peoples. God had called them from way back when he called Abraham to be a separate, cut-off people. And yet, here they're not doing that, and they're intermixing, they're marrying, they're serving their gods, they're throwing away Yahweh and turning to the gods of the Canaanites that God had told them to drive out. And that's the problem. So God, how did God handle that? Back to chapter 2, verse 14. In his anger against Israel, Yahweh handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of Yahweh was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. So since they had rejected him, he no longer was their shield, their great reward. He no longer gave them victories over their enemies. He, in fact, allowed the enemies to come in and create problems for the Israelites and conquer the Israelites and raid the Israelites. Okay? He allowed that to happen. So there you see the judgment side in response to their great sin of rejecting God. Eventually, the Israelites would remember Yahweh and would turn to him and would repent, meaning not just confess of their sin, but turn from their sin and turn from these gods that they were worshiping, and look to God for being their shield and their great reward, being their protector. How did God respond to that? Verse 16, then Yahweh raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Whenever Yahweh raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For Yahweh had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. Okay? So God would raise up a judge. Now a judge is not just the guy behind the bench in a big black robe deciding who's right and who's wrong. The word, Hebrew word here is shofet, which means leader. Okay? It could be a judge, it can be a hero, it can be a governor, it can be a leader, a director. Okay? So he raised up some kind of a leader or a hero or a judge to come and save Israel from this time. Did these judges have a lasting effect on Israel's faithfulness? Verse 19, but when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. So while the judge was around, they remained faithful, but as soon as the judge died, they turned evil again and became more corrupt than they had been before the judge. So what did God decide to do as a response to this? Therefore, Yahweh was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of Yahweh and walk in it as their forefathers did. So he allowed those nations to remain. The nations, the peoples, the pagans that the Israelites did not drive out, God allowed them to remain as a test. And we see this cycle repeated over and over again, that the people would be faithful for a time, then they would forget God, okay? And they would go away from God. They would worship the Baals and the Asherahs and mix with the Canaanites, okay? But then God would allow them to be battered. He would allow enemies to come in and raid them and create problems for them. Eventually, they would cry back out to God and turn to God. God would then bring a deliverer who would rescue them, who would emancipate them, who would take away the problem and show God's mighty hand at work in saving them. And during the time of that judge, that hero, they would be faithful. But after he was gone, they turned away again. And that's what we have in the book of Judges. And so what you then have in the next chapters are all these stories of all these different judges that popped up, and you'll see that cycle repeated over and over again. The first judge that we see, and in fact I've given you on page 5 of your handout a quick little summary. We have both major judges and minor judges, and the first judge that we see is a major judge, and he's Othniel. We don't have a whole lot of information about him. The first we hear about him is in chapter 1. He's a nephew of Caleb, and ends up marrying Caleb's daughter, so he marries his cousin and becomes Caleb's son-in-law. The story we have on Othniel is in chapter 3, starting at verse 7. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. They forgot Yahweh, their God, and served the Baals and the Asherahs. And the anger of Yahweh burned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites who were subjects for 8 years. Okay, so for 8 years. But then they finally cried out to Yahweh. He raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of Yahweh came upon him so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. Yahweh gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. So you've got this 40 years of peace while Othniel was still around. And what's interesting is you see a lot of these multiplications of 40. 40 years of peace. 40 is a number that means generation. You see a life change with 40s. You look at all the 40s in the Bible. And so if you look at the table on page 5, you'll see that the years of peace after these judges, you had 40 years with Othniel, 80 years, which is twice 40, with Ehud, and 40 with Deborah, 40 with Gideon. So you see some of that big biblical 40 there. Okay, the second judge that we have just follows right on the heels there in chapter 3. And this is a judge named Ehud. Now, we'll start in verse 12. Once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. And because they did this evil, Yahweh gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. Okay, the Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Okay, you see, it takes them a while before they get around to saying, oh yeah, we're people of Yahweh. We should not be worshiping these gods. We should turn to Yahweh. But 18 years here, it says that they suffered under the Moabites. Okay, and then God brings Ehud on the scene. The summary of the story here starts at verse 20. Ehud then approached him, that is the king of Moab, while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, I have a message from God for you. As the king rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade which came out his back. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. So we see Ehud came. He went to visit the king, bringing the tribute from Israel for that year. And you see that he assassinated the king of Moab here. Okay, he then gets away. And how does he then conquer 10,000 Moabites as the Moabites are fleeing here? Verse 27, when he arrived there, he blew a trumpet. When he arrived back into Ephraim, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. Follow me, he ordered, for Yahweh has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they struck down around 10,000 Moabites, all victorious and strong. Not a man escaped. In fact, the victory was so great that that day Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. So instead of Israel being subject to Moab, meaning that basically Moab was ruling them and they had to pay a tribute protection money to Moab annually, the tide was turned. The table was turned. And now Moab was subject to Israel. Okay? That's the second major judge. The third major judge we then have in chapter 4. Starting in verse 1, after Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. So Yahweh sold them into the hands of Jabin, a king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Hazor is up in the northern part of Israel. In fact, you might want to look too, while we're talking about some of these, at page 6. I've given you a little map here, and I know it may be hard to read, your copy might be, but you can see that these judges were kind of spread out. Othniel we see is the farthest south one, okay, way down in Debir in Judah. Okay, Ehud, you see him right near the Jordan River, okay, a little bit north of Jericho, so you see where he is. Now we'll turn to Deborah, which is just west of him, but if you look way up north, you see the Sea of Galilee, and directly north of the Sea of Galilee is a city called Hazor, and that's where the Canaanite king was. Now a lot of these troubles that they had and a lot of the judges that God raised up were somewhat localized. We see in this one here that the Canaanites had such command over the Israelites from Hazor that even Deborah gets involved way down in Ephraim territory down further south. Okay, so you can kind of look at that map and see some of that. So Deborah, by the way, verse 4, was a prophetess and she was leading Israel at that time. She held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites came to have their disputes decided. So you see that on the map there. She sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh and Naphtali, and said to him, Yahweh, the God of Israel, commands you, go take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead the way to Mount Tabor. Tabor. I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River, and will give him into your hands. Okay, and you see Zebulun and Naphtali up further north there by the Sea of Galilee. So they were closer to Hazor. So that's, she called Barak from there to raise an army there to go and fight the Canaanites and to conquer the Canaanite army there. Now, she was, it sounds like then the judge was Barak, right? Well, no, she stayed involved here. You see that as we go on. Barak said to her, verse 8, if you go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. Well, very well, Deborah said, I'll go with you. But because of the way that you're going about this, the honor will not be yours. For Yahweh will hand Sisera over to a woman, Sisera being the commander of the army. And that was the great honor of the that was due Barak as the commander of the Israelite army, was to defeat and to kill the commander of the opponent's army. But he wouldn't get to do that. So Deborah went with Barak to Kadesh. So she was there in these battles because Barak required that for him to do his job that he was called to do. So who then did receive the credit for the victory over Sisera? Verse 22. Barak came in pursuit of Sisera, and Jael went out to meet him. Okay, Jael was a woman up in the northern part. Come, she said, I will show you the man that you're looking for. So he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with a tent peg through his temple, dead. So Jael, a woman, had killed Sisera, just as Deborah had said. And so she got the credit for conquering and for the victory here over Sisera. And you've got in chapter 5 this great song that Deborah sings, and Barak's involved as well with that song, and praises God for what happened, tells the story, but also, you know, gives the credit to Jael here as well. Okay? The next major judge that we have, we go on in chapter 6, and this is the last one that we looked at last week. The oppressors get stronger and stronger as we go through, and we'll see that today as we get into the Philistines as well. The next big oppressor we see in chapter 6, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Now, Midianites were a nomadic group that would wander around, many people, so that they had to continue to move around to find land that could support them. So they didn't care whose land that might be that would support them, because usually if they would find land that would support them, that usually belonged to somebody. So they were very military oriented and very powerful. They had camels, which were kind of like the Humvees of the day. They could move very fast, could enable them to perform guerrilla warfare. And so they were very mighty, powerful warriors as well. They so these Midianites became a problem. In verse 2, because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. So they hid, and they hid themselves from the Midianites. Okay? So who does God call as a judge, and how did God confirm that call? Verse 14, Yahweh turned to Gideon and said, go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Okay, God sent an angel here to say this to Gideon. But Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan's the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family. So I'm a nobody. How could I do this? And Yahweh answered, I'll be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together. Gideon replied, well, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you talking to me. Then we go on, verse 21. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of Yahweh touched the meat and the unleavened bread that was sitting on a rock that Gideon had placed there that he had cooked. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread. And then the angel of Yahweh disappeared. Okay, so God called Gideon to save Israel from the Midianites. But Gideon was a reluctant leader, just as Moses had been, just as many of God's chosen have been. But he said, let me know for sure this is really you. So he's praying for discernment here. And God showed him. God gave him this sign of fire from the rock and then the angel disappearing. Okay. Now, did that satisfy Gideon that God would give him victory? Well, if you go on later in the chapter, we see this interesting story starting in verse 36. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand as you've promised, look, I'll place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there's dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I'll know that you will save Israel by my hand as you said. And that's what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, don't be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. This time, make the fleece dry and the ground covered with dew. Well, that night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. So Gideon's kind of pushing it. I heard a guy say, it's not good to fleece with God. But Gideon kind of pushed it and asked for more signs, but God in his patience and in his mercy gave those signs. Okay? And gave... we see Gideon was real nervous about this and was not only reluctant, but real timid about it. God even had him go down into the Midianite campsite to hear some guy talk about his dream about how God was going to send Gideon and the Israelite army to destroy the Midianites. And so that kind of helped encourage and strengthen Gideon. Okay? And then God also, he kind of pushed it the other way too. Gideon had rounded up this big army, 32,000 men, which really is not much when you look at the millions of people of Midianites that were there and the strength of their forces and their camels. But God took a look at it and said, you know, 32,000 may not be enough, but it's enough for you to think that if you had a victory, that you had a strong enough army to do so. So we need to weed this down. And through a couple of things that he does, he knocks it down to 300. And we see that the reason of that in chapter 7, verse 2. Yahweh said to Gideon, you've got too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, then I need you to reduce the people by this amount. And he knocks it down to 300. Okay, so that Israel would know that when there is a victory, there's no way 300 men, there's no way on earth that 300 men could destroy this Midianite army and get rid of these Midianites. But there is a way under heaven. So God weeded them down to 300 so that there was no way that they would be able to claim the victory, that the victory was not by man's power, but would see that it was from God. So how did 300 men defeat this massive army of Midianites? Verse 20. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hand and holding their right hands, the trumpets that they were to blow. They shouted, a sword for Yahweh and for Gideon. While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. And then, when the 300 trumpets sounded, Yahweh caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with swords. The army fled to Beth Shittah towards Zerera, as far as the border of Abel Meholah near Tabath. So God conquered them. All they had to do is make a lot of noise. There were just 300 of them. They surrounded the Midianite camp. They made some noise by breaking some jars, shining their torches, shouting out a sword for Yahweh and a sword for Gideon, and then blowing trumpets. And that threw the Midianites into a frenzy, and they conquered themselves. Okay, you then have Gideon and his men following them, pursuing them, and defeating the survivors, as well as calling out some others in Israel to come help them. And you've got those in some of the remaining verses here. So how did the Israelites respond to this victory, and how did Gideon show his faithfulness to God here? Chapter 8, verse 22. The Israelites said to Gideon, rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you've saved us out of the hand of Midian. But Gideon told them, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you. Okay? So they wanted Gideon to be their king, but he said, you've already got a king. You've got the best king you could ever have, and that's God, that's Yahweh. No man can come close to being the kind of king that Yahweh is. Okay? So he refused that. He had some failures, he had some problems, had some problems with his family. We see in chapter 9, had some problems with himself, with this gold ephod that he made. And so there's verses there that you can look at. Look at those stories. Okay? And that's where we ended last week. And we'll pick up from there. First, let's kind of quickly pick up on a few minor judges. Okay, we've got, if you look at page 5, you see 6 major judges. We've so far covered 4 of them. Okay, we've got 2 left is all. And 6 minor judges. We've only covered 1 of those. I haven't reminded you of that yet. But what's the difference between a major judge and a minor judge? Simply, how much information we have about them. For instance, the very first minor judge we have is back in Judges chapter 3, verse 31. It's a guy named Shamgar. All we know about him is what we see in this verse. It's just one verse. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. So from that we see that the enemy that was creating problems at the time was the Philistia, were the Philistines. And he killed 600 of them with an ox goad, with a prod. Okay, that's all we know about him. So that's why we call him a minor judge. Whereas the major judges will have numerous verses, sometimes chapters about them. Okay, the next minor judge we see is as we go on past chapter 9. Which is a story about Abimelech, the son of one of the sons of Gideon, and we'll touch on that on page 4 just briefly. Very interesting story, though, that you might want to look at. That I'd recommend it. Then chapter 10, we see a couple of minor judges. First, we see Tola. After the time of Abimelech, a man of Issachar, Tola, son of Puah, the son of Dodo. How would you like to have your dad or granddad named Dodo and Puah? Rose to save Israel. He lived in Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. He led Israel 23 years and then he died and was buried in Shamir. That's all we know about Tola. But we know that he was from Issachar and he lived in the hill country of Ephraim. Okay. And he led for 23 years. The next one we see is in the next verses. He was followed by Jair of Gilead, who led Israel 22 years. He had 30 sons who rode 30 donkeys. They controlled 30 towns in Gilead, which to this day are called Havoth Jair, which means settlements of Jair. When Jair died, he was buried in Kamon. So this was in a different area. This is in the area of Gilead on the eastern side. Gad is another name for that area, because the tribe of Gad settled there on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So that's about all we know of him, but he was there for 22 years. We can then jump to chapter 12 and we see the other 3 minor judges, starting in verse 8. After him, this is after Jephthah, which we'll talk about in a minute, Ibzan of Bethlehem led Israel. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters. He gave his daughters away in marriage to those outside his clan, and for his sons, he brought in 30 young women as wives from outside his clan. Ibzan led Israel 7 years, then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. So you see he was in Bethlehem there, which is in Judah. And then, after him, Elon, the Zebulunite, led Israel 10 years. Then Elon died and was buried in Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. Okay, so then you have Elon, and he's from Zebulun. And he was there for 10 years. After him, Abdon, son of Hillel, from Pirathon, led Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. By the way, riding on donkeys, that was a sign of princehood or kinghood of royalty. Would ride on donkeys. It was a sign of peace. Okay? Riding a horse was a sign of war. So he led Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, son of Hillel, died and was buried at Pirathon in Ephraim in the hill country of the Amalekites. So here you see Abdon judged for 8 years from Ephraim. Okay, those are our minor judges. Well, let's move on to our two remaining major judges. Going back to chapter 10 where we left off in verse 6. And we'll see who the enemy was here. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. Okay, you see the pattern. They served the Baals and the Ashtoreths, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. Okay, Yahweh was definitely not enough for them. Every god that they could run into, they've served. And because the Israelites forsook Yahweh and no longer served him, he became angry with them. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. Now, where are the Philistines and the Ammonites? Well, the Philistines are on the west coast, on the Mediterranean Sea, on the western side of Canaan. The Ammonites, if you remember, were way to the east. They were even to the east of Gilead. So here they're getting pressed from both sides, from the east and from the west, from the Philistines and from the Ammonites. Both sides. How did God respond when the Israelites eventually cried out under this oppression? We'll start at verse 11. Yahweh replied, when the Egyptians, the Amorites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, the Sidonians, the Amalekites, and the Maonites oppressed you and cried, and you cried to me for help, did I not save you from their hands? But you have forsaken me and served other gods, so I will no longer save you. Go and cry out to the gods that you've chosen. Let them save you when you're in trouble. Okay? So God refused to save them. You rejected me, so I reject you. But it goes on then. But the Israelites said to Yahweh, we've sinned. Do with us whatever you think best, but please rescue us now. Well, then, the important thing, they got rid of the foreign gods among them, and they served Yahweh, and he could bear Israel's mercy, Israel's misery no longer. Okay? So they repented of their sin, they turned from their sin, they confessed it, turned from it, and God forgave them. Okay? So, we move on. So there you see the sin, the judgment, and now the grace and the calling that they had and the forgiveness that God gives them, and now it's time for God to raise up a judge. We see that in chapter 11. Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also bore him sons. When they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. You're not going to get any inheritance in our family, they said, because you're the son of another woman. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, where a group of adventurers gathered around him and followed him. Well, sometime later, when the Ammonites made war on Israel, the elders of Gilead went to Jephthah from the land of Tob. Come, they said, be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites. Jephthah said to him, didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble? You know, what kind of excuse could they come up with? Well, the elders of Gilead said to him, nevertheless, we're turning to you now. Come and with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be our head over all who live in Gilead. Okay, so they had this trouble, and they turned to Jephthah. Jephthah had been an illegitimate son from a guy named Gilead, and his brothers then drove him away, said, you don't have any part of our inheritance. They drove him away. He rounded up, got together with a bunch of bad guys, but they happened to be just right for waging war on the Amorites. And so they called him back to help him. So he does, and before his battle, Jephthah does something very foolish. Verse 30. Jephthah made a vow to Yahweh, if you give the Ammonites into my hand, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be Yahweh's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Why did he do this? Why did he make this vow? Did he feel that God was not going to be faithful to his promise to bring him victory? He didn't trust God enough here. He felt like he had to make a deal. How many times do we find that we feel like we have to make a deal with God? God, if you'll only do this, I'll do that. Okay? Did he need to make this vow? Did he need to make a deal with God? No. He was God's instrument of mercy, of salvation for the Israelites here. God had prepared him for that. And yet he makes this vow. And the problem is, by making a vow to God, he has to keep it. And you see, he says, if you give me this victory, then when I go home, whatever comes out the front door, chicken, goat, whatever it is that comes out my front door, I'll sacrifice it to you. Okay? Well, what happens? Well, he has the victory, and he goes home after the victory, and what comes out of the house? Verse 34. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? And she was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you've made me miserable and wretched because I made a vow to Yahweh that I cannot break." Okay? So he made this rash vow, and now he sees the results of that. He had promised to sacrifice whatever came out. Now he was going to have to sacrifice his daughter, his only child. Okay? And if you go on and look at the story, she says, "Well, you made a vow to God. You have to do what you have to do. But give me some time, since I'll never get married. Let me go into the hills with my friends and cry about it." And so they do, and gives them some time, 2 months to go, and then she comes back, and he does fulfill his vow and sacrifice. Okay. So horrible story here, but it talks about, you know, Jesus talks in Matthew, you know, don't make vows. Don't swear on the Bible or swear to God. Okay? Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't make a vow. Because if you make a vow in God's name, you have to keep it. Okay, chapter 12, we see that there's somebody who has trouble with what Jephthah did here. Not with his daughter, but in his battle. The men of Ephraim called out their forces and crossed over to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you go fight the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? We're going to burn down your house over your head." Okay, so the tribe of Ephraim complained that they weren't asked to help fight. Well, Jephthah then in the next verses goes and says, "I did ask you, but you said no, you wouldn't help me, so I had to go on. I couldn't wait for you to change your mind." Well, the Ephraimites didn't accept that and decided to fight the Gileadites, those in Gilead. So how does... what happens here? We'll start at verse 4. Jephthah then called together the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. The Gileadites struck them down because the Ephraimites had said, "You Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim and Manasseh." The Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan leading to Ephraim. And whenever a survivor of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead asked him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he replied, "No," they said, "All right, say Shibboleth." If he said Sibboleth, because he could not pronounce the word correctly, they seized him and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. 42,000 Ephraimites were killed at that time. So since people didn't have driver's license or green cards or whatever to identify themselves, they identified who the Ephraimites were by listening for their accent, and they made them say the word Shibboleth, and if it came out as Sibboleth, then that told them that this guy was from Ephraim, and they killed him. So here you see a battle between two tribes of Israel. All right, going on, chapter 13. We'll move on to, at the end of chapter 12, we have those three minor judges that we looked at earlier. And then in chapter 13, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, so Yahweh delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. So the Philistines, the group of sea peoples, is what they're also called on the western shore on the Mediterranean Sea. These guys become a big problem for the Israelites, and we'll continue to see them in coming weeks. But here we see that they just totally become a big problem for the Israelites for 40 years here. And so this is the time of Samson. And we see that Samson, God brings up Samson, and he's set apart by God even before he's born. Okay, a certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. The angel of Yahweh appeared to her and said, "You're sterile and childless, but you're going to conceive and have a son." So we have a miracle birth here. Okay, like we've seen with Sarah and Abraham and Sarah, and with Isaac and Rebecca. Okay, we later see with Mary and Joseph and Zechariah and Elizabeth, for example, too. Now, going on, "See to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines." So even before Samson was born, he was devoted, he was dedicated to God, and with this vow of the Nazarite. And you see that in Numbers chapter 6, and it talks about what Nazarite is. People could take the vow of the Nazarite and be devoted, dedicated to God for a time, whatever that time might be, a week, a month, a year. Well, Samson would be a Nazarite for life, even before he was born. How did Samson's parents know that this message came from God? Because God had sent this angel here. And how did they know that this was not just somebody telling him this? Well, obviously, if she got pregnant and had a baby, that would be one proof. But you also see, starting in verse 19, "Manoah took a young goat together with a grain offering and sacrificed it on a rock to Yahweh. And Yahweh did an amazing thing while Manoah and his wife watched. As the flame blazed up from the altar toward heaven, the angel of Yahweh ascended in the flame. Well, seeing this, Manoah and his wife fell on their faces to the ground." So they saw this angel that they'd been talking to. He looked like a man. They saw him ascend in this flame of the sacrifice going up to heaven. So they knew that this was a message from God, and that Samson was going to be a deliverer as had been promised, because this is from God. Okay, going on. Now, Samson was, you know, some of the story. Samson was very strong. He was gifted with strength. He also had some weaknesses. He had a big weakness was, he had a problem with the women. He loved women. And this became a big problem for him over and over again, just as it is for a lot of men. Chapter 14, we see that Samson went down to Timnah, which is in Philistine territory. Okay, these people were in Dan. Dan was right next. In fact, the tribe of Dan, if you look at a map and you see where Dan is, it's right there in Philistine territory and then a little bit to the east. And really, the Danites never were able to get the Philistines out of their land, so they were really never able to take ownership of their tribe. And so they end up trying to find another place. They find some town way up north in northern Israel that there's some people living there who don't have any military protection. They're kind of isolated, and they go and they conquer it, and they name that town Dan, and that's where they move to. But so they never really take ownership of their inheritance that God had given them in this promised land. So you see a lot of interaction here with the Philistines, and so this is where Samson comes from. And so he went down to Timnah, and there he saw a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." His father and mother replied, "Isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? For heaven's sake, Samson, you're a Nazarite." But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me. She's the right one for me." His parents didn't know that this was from Yahweh, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines, for at that time they were ruling over Israel. So God used this as a way to get to the Philistines. Well, in verse 5, Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and mother. As they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring toward him. The spirit of Yahweh came upon him in power. And this is the first time we see him using his strength. So that he tore the lion apart with his bare hands as he might have torn a young goat. But he told neither his father nor his mother what he had done. Okay? So here we see his strength in action. He's attacked by a young lion, hungry lion, and he kills it. He just tears it apart and rips it apart like nothing. Okay, later on, he passes by again, and what does he see? Verse 8. Sometime later, when he went back to marry this woman, he turned aside to look at the lion's carcass. In it was a swarm of bees and some honey, which he scooped out with his hands and ate as he went along. When he rejoined his parents, he gave them some, and they too ate it. But he didn't tell them that he had taken the honey from the lion's carcass. This lion's carcass was filled with bees and honey. He goes on, he gets married to this girl, has a big wedding feast. And in those days, these wedding feasts would last days. This is kind of like the wedding at Cana. It's a big party, big celebration. Now, Samson was a Nazarite and was not to touch any wine, but the partygoers sure did. And this particular party lasted 7 days, a whole week. Okay, a big, big party. And oftentimes they would have riddles and, you know, things to kind of talk about over the course of the festival and the feast. And Samson makes a wager with 30 Philistines during his feast. Verse 12 says, "Let me tell you a riddle," Samson said to him. "If you can give me the answer within 7 days of the feast, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. But if you cannot tell me the answer, then you must give me 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes." Clothes were, and linen and cloth was very, very expensive. It was all handmade with a loom. So this was very expensive. "Tell us your riddle," they said. "Let us hear it." And he said, "Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet." Okay, what is it? Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. So he gave them this riddle. He said, "I'll bet you 30 sets of clothes, okay, one set from each of you, that you can't answer this riddle in 7 days." Okay, well, this riddle, we know, you know, this has to do with this lion, you know, out of the eater, something to eat. He had honey inside the eater, inside the lion's carcass. Out of the strong lion, there was something sweet. He knew that, but no one else knew that. He didn't even tell his parents. Well, the Philistines tried for days to figure this out, and finally on the seventh day, actually on the fourth day, they said, "Coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we'll burn you and your father's household to death. Did you invite us here to rob us?" And so Samson's wife comes to him and cajoles him and coaxes him, and she cries the whole 7 days of the feast. So on the seventh day, he finally told her because she continued to press him. She in turn explained the riddle to her people. He ends up telling his wife, who then ends up telling her people. And then before sunset on the seventh day, the men of the town said to him, "Samson, what's sweeter than honey? What's stronger than a lion?" Well, Samson knew what had happened here. They won the bet because they cheated. And he said, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Okay? You don't plow with heifers. You plow with bulls, and you plow with oxen, and you don't plow with a milk cow. And he said, "You plowed with my heifer, so you cheated." Okay? So how did he get, now he now owes 30 sets of clothes to these guys. How does he get these 30 sets of clothes to pay the bet? Verse 19. "Then the Spirit of Yahweh came upon him in power." You see his power at work here again. "He went down to Ashkelon," which is a major Philistine city, "struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their belongings, and gave their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. Burning with anger, he then went up to his father's house." He just went home. Okay? He went back home without his wife. And then what happened? Verse 20, "Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended Samson at his wedding." Okay? So his wife was given to his friend. So he kills 30 Philistines to make good on the bet. So God gives more victory against the Philistines here. All right? Well, eventually Samson realizes, hey, my wife's back there. I need to go get her. And he goes to get her and he finds out that she's been given to another man. How would someone with the might and power and strength of Samson respond to that? Chapter 15, starting at verse 3. Samson said to them, "Well, this time I have a right to get even with the Philistines. I will really harm them." So he went out and caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. Foxes usually don't like that. Okay, he had 150 sets of these. He then fastened a torch to every pair of tails. So what would the foxes do? They would tie tail to tail. They'd try to get away. They would run, right? He then fastened a torch to every pair of tails, lit the torches, and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks in the standing grain together with the vineyards and the olive groves. Okay, so he sent out these 300 foxes with torches throughout the Philistine grain fields and vineyards and olive groves. And this was at the time of harvest, it says, which at that time it would be dry. So things would take off and burn very easily. So he burned up their fields and burned up their crops. The harvest had not come in. It was harvest time. They were harvesting. So the stuff that they had cut and were ready to thresh burned up. And so he got revenge on the Philistines. But Philistines aren't too happy about this. How do they respond? Starting in verse 6. When the Philistines asked, "Who did this?" they were told, "Samson, the Timnite's son-in-law, because his wife was given to his friends." So the Philistines went up and burned her and her father to death. Samson said, "Since you've acted like this, I won't stop till I get my revenge on you." He attacked them viciously and slaughtered many of them. And then he went down and stayed in a cave in the rock of Etam. So the Philistines killed Samson's wife and his father-in-law. He then slaughtered many Philistines, and then he went hiding in this cave. And this cave was in Judah. Well, the Philistines had power over Israel at this time, right? So the Philistines tell the people in Judah, "Give them back, okay? Extradite them. Get them to us." They said, okay. They didn't have any choice. So they went and they found Samson. And said, we've got to turn you over. These people are going to destroy us. And he said, okay, that's fine. Just tie me with some rope. Get some brand new rope, tie it around me, and tie it on my arms. Just, you don't kill me. Okay? You just tie me up and give me to them, and I'll go with you peacefully. And they said, okay. And they do that, and they give him to the Philistines. And as soon as they give him to the Philistines, we see, Verse 14, as he approached Lehi, the Philistines came toward him shouting. The Spirit of Yahweh came on him in power. The ropes on his arms became like charred flax, and the bindings dropped from his hands. Finding a fresh jawbone of a donkey, he grabbed it and struck down 1,000 men. Okay, so he killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey. So you see his power at work here. Okay. So Samson has his victory. You see in verse 20 there that Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So you have some time of peace there. But again, I mentioned before, he's got a downfall. He's got a weakness, and that weakness is he's not very moral, and his longing for women and lack of discernment dealing with that. And we see that then in chapter 16. Okay, sometime later. Well, actually, you've got this little bitty story. We might as well cover it here. Verse 1. One day, Samson went to Gaza, which is a big city in Philistia, where he met a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. Okay? That's typical Samson. That's the kind of person he was. So you see his moral character there. The people of Gaza were told, "Samson's here." So they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, "At dawn, we'll kill him." But Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up, took a hold of the doors of the city gate. These are big, huge bronze or iron doors. Together with the two doorposts, and tore them loose, bar and all. He lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill. This is uphill that faces Hebron. This is miles away. So you see again his strength at work. And he shows them that who's really in control here. Who's really got the power. And then, verse 4, sometime later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. Okay, you've heard of Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him. You know, if you do this, each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver. That's 28 pounds of silver times however many officials there were there. It's a lot of money. This is more money than she has ever seen, would ever see otherwise. Okay, so very tempting to her. So she tries to get the secret out of him. And how does Samson respond? Verse 6, so Delilah said to Samson, tell me the secret of your great strength and how you can be tied up and subdued. Okay, kind of a pride thing, trying to get it out of him. Samson answered her, if anyone ties me with 7 fresh thongs, or those bowstrings, okay, that have not been dried, I'll become as weak as any other man. So he makes up this story and tells her, okay. We know that's not the case. And so she tries that out. He breaks him and it does not bind him. She tries again and again. Okay, verse 10. Then Delilah said, you made a fool of me. You lied to me. Now come now, tell me how you can be tied. He said, if anyone ties me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become as weak as any other man. And we already saw that when the people of Judah gave him over, and you saw how he broke through it like charred flax, it said there. Okay, but he said, tie me with new ropes and they can't get me. Okay, so Delilah took new ropes and tied them with him, and then with men hidden in the room, she called to him, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. But he snapped the ropes off his arms as if they were threads. Delilah then said to Samson, until now you've been making a fool of me and lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied. He replied, if you weave the 7 braids of my head into the fabric on a loom and tighten it with a pin, I'll become as weak as any other man. So while he was sleeping, what happened? Delilah took the 7 braids of his head, wove them into the fabric, and tightened it with a pin, and again said, the Philistines are on you. And he got up and pulled up the pin and the loom with the fabric. And okay, and then, as you would imagine, the next verse, so she said, how can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? Okay, so he's tugging at his strings here. This is the 3rd time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength. And then with such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death of her. Okay? So finally, finally in verse 17, he told her everything. No razor has ever been used on my head, he said, because I've been a Nazarite set apart to God since birth. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me and I would become weak as any other man. You know, I kind of wonder if he really knew that this was the case. If he was just saying this and thinking, I've got this strength no matter what happens to me. Okay, but this is going against the vow, going against the covenant of the Nazarite. Never would he touch wine. Never would he drink fermented beverage of any sort, or shave his head, or, you know, he had the vow of the Nazarite, and the things that are prescribed in number 6, he had to continue with, and if he broke any of that, then this gift of God's strength would go. And so he tells her that. What happens? Well, she does that. She has his head shaved. Having put him to sleep on her lap, verse 19, she called a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. Then she called, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He awoke from his sleep and thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. But he didn't know that Yahweh had left him. I heard someone say that that's the saddest verse in the Bible. That Yahweh left him and he didn't even know it. Then the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes and took him down to Gaza. Binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding in the prison. Okay? But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. So they took him to Gaza, which is what we saw at the beginning of chapter 16, where he had taken the city gates and carried him for miles. They took him back there. And they seized him, they gouged out his eyes, they imprisoned him, they made him grind grain, which was considered woman's work, so this is a humiliating kind of thing for him. So this is a big day for the Philistines, though. This enemy, this great enemy, Samson, that's caused so much trouble for them, they've captured him and they've weakened him and he has no strength now. And they've gouged his eyes out so he can't just go and do what he wants anymore. How do they celebrate his capture? Verse 23. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to celebrate, saying, "Our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands." Okay? While they were in high spirits, they shouted, "Bring out Samson to entertain us." So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. Okay? So they held a great party and brought out Samson and paraded him out there and showed everybody, "Look, we're more powerful. We got him. We've defeated their god. We've defeated their most powerful man." Okay? But then we see that Samson's victorious even at death. Going on. When they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hand, "Put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple so that I can lean against them." Now the temple was crowded with men and women. All the rulers of the Philistines were there, and on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. Then Samson prayed to Yahweh, "O sovereign Yahweh, remember me. O God, please strengthen me just once more, and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes." Then Samson reached toward the two central pillars on which the temple stood. Bracing himself against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other, Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. Thus he killed many more when he died than while he lived. So we see this victory. Even in death, Samson had great victory over the Philistines. Even in death, God brought salvation to the Israelites from the Philistines through Samson. Okay? Now there's a few other stories that you have in the book of Judges. In Judges 9 is a story of Abimelech. I mentioned that before. You got to kind of look at the cargo. What is the story really trying to tell us? And in Judges 9, we're seeing that leadership is chosen by God, not by man or by heredity. If you look at all the leaders, the mighty men of faith, the people who were prophets, priests, kings, leaders of his people, God's chosen ones, God's chosen leaders, they were all chosen by God. None of them decided to do it on their own. Whenever we see a story of someone wanting to become a prophet or a priest or a king on his own, they fail. Okay? God takes care of them. They're only appointed by God. And so that's what we have as in Judges 9. This is an example of that story. Judges 17 to 18, we have this interesting story of Micah and his idols and the Danites and the tribe of Dan. And I'll just let you read that on your own, but you see that the Israelites were so misled, so polluted by the various gods and religions and idols and all that, that they thought that if they had a priest, if they had a Levite and the Levites idols, then that would bring them victory. Okay, we'll see this more as we continue on. That they put, the Israelites put their trust in something that God gives them as a symbol, rather than in God himself. Luckily, we don't do that anymore, right? there's that story in those chapters. And then in chapters 19 through 21, we've got another story about another Levite and his concubine and the Benjamites. And basically, there's very extreme corruption and immorality in the Benjamite clan here. And when they were called to task about it by the other Israelites, rather than turning over the evil ones who created who had raped and killed this Levite's concubine, they defend him and defend him in war. So the Israelites come out and fight the Benjamites and basically destroy the tribe of Benjamin. There's a tiny remnant left, and that there's chapter 21 talks a little bit about that too, how they try to replenish that tribe, because you know, they had to wipe out the cancer from the body, but they didn't want to lose that part of the body. And that's the tribe of Benjamin. The body is incomplete without that tribe. And so you've got all that story in there. There's another story that happens during the time of the judges, and that's what we'll look at next week, the story of Ruth. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us in your word, the stories in the books of Judges where we see how the Israelites continue to fall away from you and turn from you and disobey you and fall from faith. But yet, although you punish them, you're a just God and you punish sin, you also accept their confession. You accept their repentance. You accept them back into your fold. You accept them back with your forgiveness. We thank you for that because we need that ourselves as well. We continue to fall from you and fall short of your standards and what you've called us to do. But yet, you promise that as we repent, as we confess, as we turn from our sin and turn to you, that you're there with open arms to welcome us back and to forgive us and to bring us and to give us the promised land, the land that you've promised to give us with your Son, Jesus Christ, the one who's made this all possible. In his name we pray. Amen.